The carry-all doors shut beneath it like the mouth of a gluttonous snake. I believe the Emperor has called it a crime to keep so much spice. Stilgar smiled as he shouted up to his companion. Is it not good to assist the Corinos in their quest for justice? Perhaps Leet should ask Shaddam to give us a commendation. Chuckling at the irony, Turok brought the lumbering vessel back around and hovered just above the ground. The remaining Fremen climbed aboard, dragging the squirming, maimed Harkonnen captives with them. The laden aircraft rode low in the sky, but accelerated as it headed out over the open desert, toward the nearest siege. Seated against a vibrating bulkhead, Stilgar studied his exhausted men, and the doomed prisoners who would soon be thrown into the death stills. He exchanged satisfied grins with his men, who had removed their face masks to reveal weathered, bearded faces. In the low light of the carryall's interior, their blue-within-blue eyes glowed. "Spice and water for the tribe," Stilgar said. "A good haul for one day." Beside him, one of the Harkonnen soldiers moaned and opened his eyes. It was the young, terrified man who had looked at him before. In a moment of mercy, deciding this one had suffered enough, Stilgar drew his kris knife and slit the soldier's throat, then covered the wound to absorb the blood. The other Harkonnens did not receive a similar kindness. It is astonishing how foolish humans can be in groups, especially when they follow their leaders without question. States, the Bene Gesserit view, all states are an abstraction. The Imperial fleet arrived at Corona without warning, the next blow in Shaddam's great spice war. With 8 battle cruisers and fully armed frigates, it was a show of force even more fearsome than the one that had blackened the most populous cities of Xanovar. The military vessels converged upon the artificial moon for an on-site investigation. Over the comm system, Supreme Bashar Zumgaron issued his ultimatum. "We are here by order of the Padishah Emperor. You, House Richiz, are charged with possessing an undocumented stockpile of melange, strictly against the laws set forth in Imperial and Landsrad courts." The hardened commander then waited for their response. Let's see how guilty they act. Desperate pleas erupted from the control rooms of Corona, echoed moments later by appeals from the Richizian government below. The Supreme Bashar, staring out from the flagship bridge, accepted none of the transmissions. He spoke into a loudspeaker system. "By order of His Awesome Majesty Shaddam IV, we will search for contraband melange. If found, the spice will be confiscated, and Corona Station will be summarily destroyed. Thus, the Emperor has commanded." 2 battle frigates slipped into the artificial laboratory moon's receiving bays. The Richizian fools attempted to reseal the airlock doors, so 2 cruisers fired upon other docking bays, blasting open the hatches and spewing air, cargo, and bodies into space. As docking collars clanged together and grappling claws forced open the sealed hull of the moon, Garon transmitted a further warning. "Any resistance will be met with extreme measures. You have precisely 2 hours to evacuate Corona. If we find evidence sufficient to warrant the annihilation of this facility, any person remaining on the station at that time will die." From the flagship bridge, Garon stepped into a lift that carried him down to the disembarkation level. Corona did not have sufficient defenses to resist the Sardaukar. No one did. The veteran commander led a full regiment into the orbiting laboratory. Through the metal corridors, alarms rang, lights flashed, sirens echoed. Inventors, technicians, and lab workers scrambled toward evacuation ships. At the hub of a walkway system, the Supreme Bashar gestured for his soldiers to separate into teams and begin their search. They understood that it might be necessary to torture a few employees to determine the location of the stockpile. A florid-faced man stumbled like a cannonball out of a lift tube, rushing from his administrative center to meet the Sardaukar vanguard. He flailed his hands. "You can't do this, sir! I am Laboratory Director Flint O'Kinnis, and I tell you that 2 hours is not enough time. We don't have sufficient ships. We need to recall vessels from Richese just for the people, not to mention all the research materials. It will take at least a day to evacuate." Garon's weathered face showed no sympathy. "The Emperor will not have his orders questioned or resisted in any manner." He nodded to his soldiers, who opened fire, slicing the shocked bureaucrat apart, even as he spluttered more objections. The troops moved deeper into the giant laboratory station. During one of their private dinners together, Shaddam had taken Zoom Garon into his confidence and explained his intent. The Emperor understood that many civilians could die in this invasion, and he was perfectly willing to make another extreme example like Zanovar, and another, until his rule was secure. "The only thing I require," Shaddam had said, holding up one finger, "is for you to retrieve all the contraband spice you find. A large enough reward of spice will minimize guild and Choam complaints." He smiled, pleased with his plan. "Then use atomics to destroy the whole station."
"Sire, using atomics goes beyond the line."
"Nonsense. We'll be giving them a chance to evacuate, and I am simply obliterating a metal structure out in space.
I understand Corona is quite an orbital eyesore."
To Shaddam's frustration, Garon did not look entirely convinced.
"Don't concern yourself with legal nuances, Bashar. The point I am trying to make is best punctuated with nuclear explosives. It will frighten the Landsrad more than 1,000 smaller warnings."
Zoom Garon had lived many harsh years on Seleucia Secundus, and had fought in the Akazi Revolt. He knew that Imperial orders were meant to be carried out, never questioned. And he had raised his talented son Kando to believe the same thing. Within half an hour, the first group of evacuation ships blundered their way down to the surface. Scientists scrambled to retrieve experimental records and irreplaceable notes from research projects. But many who wasted time gathering such items soon found themselves stranded when all the available shuttlecraft had departed. Below, in Triad Center, Premier Ein Kalamar bellowed impotently into the comm system, demanding that he be given time to contact the Landsrad Court. Beside him, Count Richese wrung his hands and pleaded, but to no effect. Simultaneously, the Richesians struggled to launch surface-based rescue ships, though with the clock ticking down, the Sardaukar leader doubted they would arrive in time. Troops ransacked laboratory chambers, searching for the alleged melange stockpile. Near the armored core of Corona, they encountered two frantic inventors, a bald scientist with sloping shoulders, and an intense man whose eyes flicked back and forth as if his mind was working at high speed. The intense inventor stepped forward, trying to look reasonable.
"Sir, I am working on a vital research project, and I must transport all my notes and delicate prototypes. This work cannot be reproduced elsewhere, and has repercussions for the future of the Imperium."
"Denied." The inventor blinked, as if he hadn't heard correctly. Beside him, the bald man narrowed his gaze.
"Let me speak."
He gestured to a pyramid of sealed crates, where workers stood with anti-grav lift trucks, but no place to go.
"Supreme Bashar, my name is Talis Balt. My colleague Halloa Rund does not exaggerate the importance of our work here. Also, look at this valuable stockpile. You can't allow it to be destroyed."
"Is that melange?" Garon said. "I have orders to remove any and all spice."
"No, sir. Richesian mirrors, nearly as valuable as spice."
The officer pursed his lips.
Tiny chips of Richesian mirrors could power large scanning devices. The hoard of reflective units here would be sufficient to power a small sun.
Thomas Balt, I regret to inform you that your director was a casualty of this operation. Therefore, I appoint you to be in charge of Corona.
Balt's jaw went slack as he absorbed the import of the Supreme Bashar's words.
Director Kinnis? He asked in a weak voice. Dead?
Garon nodded. You have my permission to remove all of the Richesian mirrors you can place aboard my ships in time, provided you tell me where to find your illegal spice hoard.
Alloa Rund still seemed appalled.
What about my research?
I cannot sell equations.
Balt squirmed, obviously considering whether or not to lie.
I assume your men will ransack laboratories and destroy sealed chambers until you find it. Therefore, I will save us all the misery.
He told the Bashar where to look.
I am pleased to see that you have made the correct decision, and that you have verified the presence of Melange.
Touching a button on his uniform, Garon sent a signal back to his ship. Moments later, low-ranking soldiers ran aboard, carrying suspensor pallets laden with containers of atomics. He turned back to the bald scientist.
You may move what you can aboard our battle cruisers, and I will permit you to keep half of what you load.
Appalled at the situation, but smart enough not to argue, Balt set to work. A bemused Garon watched the efforts of workers as they moved crates of the fragile mirrors. Clearly, they would not rescue even a tenth of the treasure. Alloa Rund rushed back to his laboratory, but the Sardaukar Bashar left instructions that he not be allowed to clutter the ships with useless prototypes. Garon directed his men to the Melange storage area, where soldiers with holo recorders documented the illegal stockpile, taking evidence before moving the spice, just in case the Emperor needed it. Shaddam hadn't stipulated this precaution, but the Bashar knew evidence was evidence. As Zoom Garon monitored the operations, Sardaukar infantry entered the moon's core, bearing their first load of nuclear warheads. He looked at his chronometer. Less than an hour remained. Talis Balt scurried back and forth, close to dropping from exhaustion. Sweat glistened on his bald pate. He and his crew had already loaded a surprising number of the expensive mirrors aboard the Sardaukar flagship. On a Corona cargo dock, Alloa Rund sat hunched and weeping beside hastily packaged crates that had been blasted open with hand weapons. When he had insisted on carrying them toward the docked flagship, two soldiers had opened fire, destroying the no-field machinery inside. As time ran out, and the Supreme Bashar ordered a retreat from the doomed satellite, Talis Balt stood on the loading dock, waiting to get away. Calmly, Garon informed the bald inventor that he would have to remain behind.
I am sorry, but it is illegal for us to permit civilian passengers to ride aboard an Imperial military warship. You must find your own way off the moon.
With little time remaining, Run's family connections with Count Ilban Rachiz would not help him. And the atomic weaponry could not be deactivated. 10 minutes before the appointed time, all Imperial battle cruisers and support ships detached themselves from the satellite, leaving the damaged docking bay doors open to the hard vacuum of space. Aboard the flagship, Supreme Bashar Garon watched his troops wrap up their operations with military precision. Though the horde of Melange had not been as extensive as the Emperor had been led to believe, the cargo compartments below decks contained many crates of Richesian mirrors, as well as the spice stockpile. The Sardaukar would immediately present the confiscated Melange to guild representatives on board the waiting Highliner. A shameless bribe, but effective. On the surface of the planet, Premier Calamar looked into the sky at the satellite moon, an artificial structure so large that it dwarfed the fleet of Sardaukar ships moving away from it.
His stomach was knotted, his heart nearly frozen with fury at the injustice of Shaddam's action. How had the Emperor learned about the spice hidden on Corona? After Baron Harkonnen had quietly paid him, Kalamar had kept the stockpile absolutely secret. Certainly the information could not have come from the Harkonnens, because that would only direct questions back at them. When the atomics erupted on Corona, bright light seared through the Richesian sky. However, instead of dimming as time went on, the fireball continued to build in a chain reaction that ignited the remaining Richesian mirrors, spreading the fragments in a cloud of broken, powerful crystals that rained through the atmosphere like shards from a supernova. Below, the Richesians of an entire continent stared into the firestorm that showered across the sky. Priceless mirrors fell like tiny asteroids, screaming and searing through the air. Kalamar bit back an outcry, but he could not stop staring. The awful light grew brighter. Many Richesians watched in mesmerized horror, unable to believe what was happening. Within the next few days, as the retinal damage progressed, fully a quarter of Richese's population would go blind. I feel the invulnerable and sliding thrust of space, where a star sends lingering beams across the undistance called parsecs. The Apocrypha of Muad'Dib. All is permitted. All is possible. Lost in emptiness, the Highliner tumbled out of control. Gurney Halleck knew something was wrong the instant they emerged from fold space. The giant vessel lurched as if it had run into thick turbulence. Placing a hand on a blade concealed inside his drab traveling clothes, Gurney looked beside him to make sure Romber remained safe. The cyborg prince anchored himself to a wall, which had now become the floor. "Are we under attack?" He wore a cloak and cowled hood, as if he were a pilgrim. Loose wool-weave fabric covered his mostly artificial body, so no one would notice the extraordinary differences in his anatomy. The cabin door of their private passenger quarters slid halfway open, then jammed in its track. Outside, in the main corridor, a service panel sparked as a power surge rippled through the frigate's systems. The decks tilted as gravity generators went offline, shifting the center of mass. Lights flickered. Then, with a creaking shudder, the passenger frigate righted itself as the Highliner rolled. Gurney and Romber struggled to the jammed cabin door and tried to push it the rest of the way open. With one powerful mechanical arm, Romber shoved the blockage aside, scraping metal. The two men slipped into the corridor where panicky passengers scurried about, some of them injured and bleeding. Through widely spaced portholes, Gurney and Romber could see the havoc in the Highliner cargo hold outside, where ships were tilted and smashed. Some drifted free, sprung from their docking clamps. On every deck, communications boards lit up as hundreds of passengers demanded explanations. Black-uniformed Waku stewards hurried from lounge to lounge, calmly instructing everyone to wait until further information was received. The attendants looked sleek and aloof, but showed an edge of strain from this unprecedented situation. Gurney and Romber headed to the crowded main lounge, where frightened passengers were gathering. From the half-hidden expression on Romber's hooded face, Gurney could see he wanted to calm these people, to take charge. To prevent this, he gave a subtle hand signal, warning the prince that they must keep their identities secret and draw no attention to themselves. Instead, the prince worked to discover for himself what had happened, but the ship's systems offered little information. Romber's waxy face was furrowed in deep concentration. "We don't have time to delay. We're on a very precise schedule. The whole battle plan could fall apart if we don't do our job." After an hour of unanswered questions and mounting panic, a guild representative finally sent a hollow emissary into the frigate lounge.
His image appeared inside the primary gathering points of all vessels within the hold. From his uniform, Romber recognized the guildsman's rank as flight auditor, a relatively important administrator who maintained accounting records and cargo and passenger manifests, and interfaced with the guild bank regarding payments for interstellar passage. The flight auditor had extremely wide-set eyes, a high forehead, and a thick neck. His arms appeared too short for his torso, as if the parts had been mismatched during his genetic assembly. He spoke in a flat voice with an annoying tick that made him sound like a buzzing insect. "We have experienced difficulty in translocation of this vessel and are currently trying to re-establish contact with our navigator in his chamber. The guild is investigating the matter. We have no further information at this time." The passengers began to shout out questions, but the projection either couldn't hear them or didn't care to reply. He stood straight-backed and expressionless. "All maintenance and major repairs to guild ships must be done at Junction. We currently have no facilities to complete major repairs here. We have not yet been able to determine our precise location, though preliminary measurements show we are in uncharted space, far beyond the Imperium." The collective inrush of the passengers' breath sounded like a heavy-duty air exchanger. Gurney scowled at Romber. "Guild representatives might be good at mathematical studies, but apparently they have no training in tact." Romber frowned. "A lost highliner? I've never heard of such a thing. Vermilion hells, this ship is one of the best Ixion designs." Gurney gave him a rueful, scar-faced smile. "Nevertheless, it's happened." He quoted from the Orange Catholic Bible. "For mankind is lost, even with the righteous path laid out for him." Romber surprised him by responding with the second half of the verse. "Yet no matter how far we stray, God knows where to find us, for he can see the whole universe." The Ixion prince lowered his voice and guided Gurney away from the grumbling conversation and sour stench of fear sweat inside the crowded lounge. "This highliner design was built under the direction of my father, and I know how these ships work. One of my duties as the Prince of House Vernius was to learn everything about ship manufacture. The quality controls and safety features were extraordinary, and Holtzmann engines never fail. That technology has proven reliable for 10,000 years. Until today." Romber shook his head. "No, that's not the answer. It can only be a problem with the navigator himself." "Pilot error?" Gurney lowered his voice to avoid eavesdroppers, though the passengers were doing a fine job of feeding their own panic. "This far outside the boundaries of the Imperium, if our navigator has failed, we'll never find our way home." Other memory is a wide, deep ocean. It is available to help the members of our order, but only on its own terms. A sister invites trouble when she tries to manipulate the internal voices to her own needs. It is like trying to make the sea one's own personal swimming pool. An impossibility, even for a few moments. The Bene Gesserit Coda. At last, back in his apartments on Kaitain, after planting his test samples in two highliners, Count Hasimir Fenring rolled out of bed and gazed around the opulent room. He wondered how soon he would hear results. He certainly couldn't ask the guild, so he would have to be very discreet in his inquiries. Through sleep-bleary eyes, he saw gold filigree on the walls and ceiling, reproductions of ancient paintings and exotic Chindo carvings. This was a far more stimulating place than dry Arrakis, scabrous Ix, or utilitarian Junction. The only finer beauty he wanted to see was the exquisite face of lovely Margot, but she had already arisen and left their bed. After his roundabout journey from highliner to highliner, he had arrived after midnight, exhausted.
Despite the late hour, Margaret had used her seductive skills on him, techniques to both arouse and relax. Then he had fallen asleep, lulled by the comfort of her arms. The Count had been out of touch with the Imperium for nearly 3 weeks, and he wondered how many blunders Shaddam had made in the meantime. Fenring would have to arrange a private meeting with his childhood friend to discuss matters, though he would keep the tale of the face dancer assassin secret for now. The spice minister intended to get his own personal revenge against Ajitika, and he would savor it greatly. Only afterward would he tell Shaddam, and they would both chuckle with pleasure. First, though, he had to learn if the master researcher's work was successful. Everything depended on Amal. If the tests proved Ajitika's claims false, Fenring would show no mercy. If the Amal worked as promised, though, he would have to learn every aspect of the process before he began the torture. Two of his suspensor-borne suitcases still sat on a broad dressing table. The bags were open. He sighed, stretched, and walked away from the bed. Yawning, he strolled into the adjacent bathing spa, where the withered maidservant Mapes bowed, though only slightly. The Fremen woman wore a white house dress that left her tanned, scarred arms bare. Fenring didn't much care for her personality, but she was a good worker and tended to his needs, albeit humorlessly. He removed his shorts and dropped them on the floor. Mapes retrieved them with a scowl and tossed them into a laundry shredder on the wall. He donned the usual protective goggles, used his voice to command the spa jets. Powerful bursts of warm water surrounded his body, lifting him into the air, massaging him on all sides. On Arrakis, such luxuries were not possible, even for the Imperial Spice Minister. He closed his eyes. So soothing. Abruptly, he jolted to awareness as peripheral details took on relevance. He had left his suspensor-borne luggage on the floor the night before, intending to unpack in the morning. Now the bags were open on a dressing table. He had hidden a test sample of the Amal in one of the suitcases. Hurrying into the bedchamber, still naked and wet, he found the Fremen housekeeper removing clothing and toiletries from the bags, putting articles away. "Leave that until later. I will call you when I need you." "As you wish." She had a throaty voice, as if grains of storm-blown sand had scarred her vocal cords. She looked with disapproval at the puddles he dripped on the floor, disgusted by the waste rather than the mess. But the secret luggage compartment was empty. Alarmed, Fenring called after her. "Where is the pouch I had in here?" "I saw no pouch, sir." He searched feverishly through the bags, scattering items onto the floor, and broke into a sweat. Just then, Margaret entered, carrying a breakfast tray. She eyed his naked form with raised eyebrows and a smile of approval. "Good morning, dear. Or should I say good afternoon?" She glanced at the wall chronometer. "No, you still have another minute." She wore a shimmering parasilk dress with pale yellow Imian roses sewn into it, tiny flowers that remained alive in the fabric and gave off a delicate, sweet scent. "Did you remove a green pouch from my suitcase?" A skilled Bene Gesserit in her own right, Margaret would have easily located the secret compartment. "I assumed you brought it for me, darling." Smiling prettily, she placed the breakfast tray on a side table. "Well, this time it was a difficult trip, and I..." She pretended to pout. Margaret had noticed a tiny symbol in one fold of the pouch, a character that she deciphered as the letter A in the Tleilaxu alphabet. "Where did you put it, Despite Ejitika's reassurances, Fenring was not at all convinced that Pleilaxu's synthetic melange wasn't harmful or even poisonous. He preferred to use others as test subjects, not himself or his wife.
"Don't worry about that right now, my dear."
Margaret's gray-green eyes danced seductively. She began to pour spice coffee for them.
"Do you want breakfast before or after we resume where we left off last night?"
Pretending lack of concern, though Margaret would note every flicker of uneasiness in his body, Fenring grabbed a black casual suit from the walk-in closet.
"Just tell me where you put the pouch and I'll get it myself."
Emerging from the closet, he saw Margaret lifting a coffee cup to her lips. Spice coffee. The hidden pouch. The Amal.
"Stop!"
He rushed toward her and knocked the cup out of her hands. Hot liquid splattered all over the hand-woven carpet and stained her yellow dress. The still-living Imian roses flinched.
"Now you've wasted all that spice, dear," she said, startled but coolly trying to regain her composure.
"Surely you didn't pour all of it in the coffee, Where's the rest of the spice you found?" He calmed himself, but knew he had already revealed far too much.
"It's in our kitchen."
She regarded him with Bene Gesserit scrutiny.
"Why are you behaving this way, dearest?"
Without explaining, he poured the remaining cup of spice coffee back into the pot and hurried out of the room with it. Grim-faced, Shaddam stood at the entrance to Anirul's chambers, with his arms crossed over his chest. A ponytailed Sukh doctor stood beside him. The truth-sayer, Mohiam, refused to let them enter the bedroom suite. "Only Bene Gesserit medical practitioners can tend to certain ailments, sire." The slope-shouldered doctor spat his words at Mohiam.
"Do not assume that the sisterhood knows more than a graduate of the Sukh inner circle."
He had ruddy features and a wide nose. Shaddam scowled. "This makes no sense. After my wife's bizarre behavior at the zoo, she needs special attention." He pretended concern, but was more interested in hearing his Supreme Bashar's debriefing as soon as the Imperial Sardaukar fleet returned from Corona. "Oh, what an account that would be." Mohiam remained firm. "Only a qualified medical sister can deal with her, sire." Her voice took on a smoother undertone. "And the sisterhood will provide such services without charge to House Corino." The Sukh doctor began to snap at her, but the emperor silenced him. Sukh services were very expensive, more than Shaddam wanted to spend on Anirul.
"Perhaps it would be best, after all, if my dear wife is tended by one of her own."
Beyond the tall doors, Lady Anirul slept fitfully, and occasionally burst out long streams of meaningless words and odd sounds. Though she didn't admit it to anyone, Shaddam was quietly pleased that she might be going mad. A small, feisty woman in a black robe, medical sister Aver Yosa carried only a small shoulder satchel as she bustled into the bedchamber, ignoring Sardaukar guards and protocol. Lady Margaret Fenring locked the apartment to prevent interruption and looked over at Mohiam, who nodded. Efficiently, Yosa gave the Kwisatz mother an injection at the back of her neck. "She is being overwhelmed by the voices within. This will dampen other memory so she can rest." Yosa stood at the bedside, shaking her head. She drew conclusions quickly, with complete confidence. "Anirul may have probed too deeply without the support and guidance of a companion sister. I have seen such cases before, and they are most serious. A form of possession."
"She will recover?" Mohiam asked.
"Anirul is a Bene Gesserit of hidden rank, and this is a most delicate time for her duties." Yosa did not mince words.
"I know nothing of her rank or duties. In medical matters, especially questions involving the intricate workings of the mind, there are no simple answers. She has suffered a seizure, and the continuing presence of these voices has had a disturbing effect on her. "See how peacefully she sleeps now," Margaret said in a soft voice. "We should leave her. Let her dream." The sleeper dreamed of the desert. A solitary sandworm fled across the dunes, trying to escape a relentless pursuer, something as silent and implacable as death. The worm, though immense, seemed minuscule in the vast sea of sand, vulnerable to forces much greater than itself. Even inside the dream, Anirul felt the blistering hot sands against her raw skin. Thrashing in her bed, she kicked off her silky coverings. She longed for the coolness of a shady oasis. With a jolt, she found herself inside the mind of the sinuous creature, her thoughts traveling through non-human neural pathways and synapses. She was the worm. She felt the friction of silica beneath her segmented body, igniting fires in her belly as she made a frantic attempt to escape. The unknown pursuer drew closer. Anirul wanted to dive into the safe depths of the sand, but she could not. In her nightmare there was no sound, not even the noise of her own passage. She let out a silent scream through a long throat lined with crystal teeth. "Why am I fleeing? What do I fear?" Suddenly she sat up, her eyes fire red and filled with abject terror. She had fallen onto the cool floor. Her body was bruised and abraded, soaked with perspiration. The mysterious disaster was still out there, approaching. But she could not understand what it was. Humans are different in private than in the presence of others. While the private persona merges into the social persona in varying degrees, the union is never complete. Something is always held back. Bene Gesserit teaching. As the sun set behind him, Duke Leto Atreides stood with Thufir Hawat and Duncan Idaho on either side of him, facing the expectant crowd that was gathered on a rocky area along the shore. Another spectacle to impress the populace before his troops went off to war. While Romber and Gurney were gone, waiting was the hardest part. Accompanied by liveried guards and representatives of Caladan's major towns, Leto looked behind him, lifting his gaze toward the magnificent monument he had commissioned, one that would serve as a lighthouse and more. On an outthrust spit of land that bounded a narrow cove, the towering stone image of Paulus Atreides stood as a guardian of the coastline, a colossus visible to all ships approaching the docks. The statue, resplendent in matador costume, rested a paternal hand on the shoulder of the innocent, wide-eyed victor. Paulus's other hand held a self-feeding brazier filled with flammable oils. The old duke had died in the bull ring years before Victor's birth, and so the pair had never actually met. Still, these two had been a tremendous influence on Leto, his political philosophy shaped by the unbending leadership of his father, and his compassion grown from love for his son. Leto's heart had a hollow feeling. Every day, as he occupied himself with the business of running House Atreides, he felt alone without Jessica. He wished she could be with him now, to participate in the formal dedication of this spectacular new monument, though he supposed she might disapprove of the extravagance lavished on the memory of his father. So far he had received no message from Romber and Gurney, but by now he could only hope they had arrived safely on Ix and were beginning their dangerous work. House Atreides would soon be embroiled in much more than the unveiling of statues. A temporary scaffold rose behind the statues. Two muscular youths scrambled to the top of the platform and waited above the brazier,
torches in hand. Selected from a local seining crew, the acrobatic boys normally spent their days clambering around in the rigging like flying crabs. Their proud parents, as well as the captains of their boats, waited below with an Atreides honor guard. Leto drew a deep breath. All people of Caladan owe a debt of gratitude to those immortalized here. My father, the beloved Duke Paulus, and my son Victor, whose life was cut so tragically short. I have ordered the creation of this memorial so that all ships entering and leaving our harbor can remember these revered heroes. The business of being a duke. Leto raised his hand in a signal, and the last dying sunlight flashed off the signet ring on his finger. From their precarious position, the youths lowered their firebrands to the brazier, igniting the oils. Blue flames roared high without crackling or smoking. A silent torch in the palm of the statue's giant hand. Duncan held the old duke's sword in front of him, as if it were a royal scepter. Thufir remained grim and emotionless. Let the eternal flame never be extinguished. May their memories burn brightly forever. The crowd cheered, but the applause could not warm Leto's heart as he remembered the quarrel he'd had with Jessica about naming their unborn child after his father. He wished she had been able to meet the old man, perhaps even to talk philosophy with him. Then maybe she would have a better opinion of Paulus, rather than focusing her ire on his policies, which Leto refused to change. He raised a gray-eyed gaze to the implacable, idealized face of Paulus Atreides beside the achingly beautiful statue of the boy. The glow from the eternal torch cast a halo around their giant-sized features. Oh, how Leto missed his father and his son. And Jessica, most of all. Please let my second child have a long and meaningful life, he thought, not entirely sure to whom he prayed. Across the Imperium, on another balcony, watching another sunset, Jessica thought about her Duke. She stared across the glorious architecture of the Imperial City, lifted her gaze to the competing colors of Aurora curtains shimmering against the dusk. How she longed to be with Leto. Her whole body ached for him. Earlier in the day, Reverend Mother Mohiam and the newly arrived medical sister Yosa had tested and prodded her, then assured Jessica that her pregnancy was proceeding normally as she entered her final trimester. In order to make certain the child was developing well, Yosa had wanted to perform a sonogram, using machines that would send harmless pulses into Jessica's womb and take hollow images of the baby growing inside. Technically, such procedures did not violate the Bene Gesserit strictures against tampering with children in utero. But Jessica had flatly refused the test, afraid it would reveal too much. Seeing the surprised, annoyed expression on the medical sister's face, Mohiam took Jessica's side, showing rare compassion. There will be no sonograms, Yosa,